Hello, friends, and welcome to the Optimized Advisor Podcast, where we focus on optimizing the well-being and best practices of insurance and financial professionals today. On this show, our objective is to help you optimize your life, optimize your profession, and learn from other Optimized Advisors. I'm your host, Scott Heinola. We hope you enjoy the show. Garrett Nyberg, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So first and foremost, disclosure, before I do your, you know, printed bio, you are my trusted CPA.
Yes.
Absolutely. So for all of the listeners, they make it be known.
Yep.
You do work wonders for me, and I appreciate you.
Yes, of course.
Very, very much. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah. Glad to be
here. A lot is happening in the world of taxes and tax planning.
Abundance. Yes. It's exactly. Overwhelming.
It really is.
The last year has just been crazy.
And it's like kind of like the analogy is kind of like trying to catch water. It's just like a kind of an it's an impossible task.
Yeah.
You can only capture so much at a time and it's just pouring out.
Yep.
How do we make sense of it all? Hopefully we can accomplish some of that today.
Yeah. A little.
All right, so Garrett Nyberg is a partner at Boroff & Nyberg LLP, a tax accounting and consulting CPA firm in Orange County. He specializes in small and medium businesses and business owners. You are a CPA and received at your bachelor in accounting at our alma mater, right?
Yep.
California State University, Long Beach.
Yeah, go Beach.
Go Beach, go Dirtbags.
Go Dirtbags, yeah. Yeah,
that's right. I love that you added the personal touch here. You live in North Tustin with your wife, Katie, 2 children, 3 dogs, 6 chickens. So how many eggs do you get in a day? There's no joke about this. I mean, I'm very envious about people who actually can own chickens.
It took a while to get them because we had a special area for it. We had to build a nesting box and everything, and we have coyotes like crazy,
right?
And so I really had to like reinforce it. And
what about owls? Because
Owls, hawks.
Yeah, they'd be gone in a month.
Bobcats.
Oh my gosh,
I haven't seen a bobcat yet, but yesterday I chased away a coyote in the middle of the day at our chicken coop because I had a little dog going crazy, big dog going crazy, and I just chased him out of the backyard. But they haven't started laying eggs yet.
Oh, so they're babies.
About 6 months old.
Okay.
Then they start laying eggs.
Got it.
So they're smaller breed of chicken. My wife got them because she likes fancy, cool looking things. So they're really fluffy looking.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they got big fluffy heads and they're really docile, love to be held. They're like kid friendly chickens.
Yeah. My in-laws have a big place in New Zealand and they have a lot of chickens too.
Yeah.
And my youngest son is like the chicken whisperer. I mean, he picks them up and carries them all around, and yeah. He loves them.
Yeah, they're fun.
And they produce eggs.
Yeah.
That's useful.
We're hoping...
As opposed to a cat. A cat is the most useless domestic animal I can think of. Half the time, they don't even want to spend time with you. They'd rather not.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just a little insight on my feeling of cats versus chickens.
Yeah, so the chickens will hopefully get eggs in the next month.
Sweet.
So I'll send you pictures.
Yeah, you'll be an egg factory at 6.
I hope so. Well, we don't know if any of them are a rooster yet.
Oh.
It takes a while.
Got it.
So they're like at the stage now where we're like, okay, is that a rooster? I hope it's not, you know.
Because they're starting to develop their mature
feathers.
Yeah,
these ones are hard to tell because they're a weird breed and they're smaller. Okay. But really you're looking for them, the sounds they make. So the rooster will get louder.
Of course.
Louder and louder. And he'll be a little more aggressive. So we know one we're pretty sure is. I'm hoping the other one isn't.
Okay.
Because you only need one if you want to like reproduce.
Freedom. Right.
And we have now my wife got these chickens.
I'm hoping everyone you have them. 5 hens.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah.
And only one rooster.
One rooster. And hopefully he's not super loud and we have to get rid of him. But cause I've heard horror stories where people talk about their rooster going nuts at like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah. And then not stopping.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully that's not the case for you. Well, we did not come here to talk about hens, although I love the fact that you have hens. We're going to be talking about a much more interesting topic in taxes. Yes. So just sexy, sizzle, yes. Screams excitement.
I love it.
Okay, a lot going on. So I thought maybe we could kind of unpack a few, two or three, you know, timely topics within the tax planning world, one at a time. And without question, I think the first one that we should probably dive into is this whole Biden's tax increase plan. But you know what? Actually, before we do that, why don't you talk a little bit about your firm?
Oh, yeah. Perfect. So you want me to give you like a my kind of like...
We don't need to elaborate on how you and I came into the fold, but it was by chance. I mean, yeah. It just was kind of random happenings that you and I found each other and...
Yeah.
It's been great ever since. So I'm actually very appreciative that these sometimes things happen just kind of unplanned and unexpected for very much so the better.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a quick history. So my dad was a CPA. So, you know, growing up, like my dad, you know, the lifestyle we lived, I was like, oh, I want that lifestyle. So I know what I want to do. I want to become a CPA because I do what he does and I'll be fine. And my dad told me when I was going through college, you know, he goes, just go straight into tax. Cause there's two options. You either go do auditing when you first graduate or you go into tax. Most people go into auditing because you have to get the auditing experience in order to do audited financial statements. Mm. But my dad told me, he goes, you don't need to do that. You know,
bypass that,
just bypass that. Don't waste your time. Jump right into tax, start building your book of business as soon as you can. Because if you go do audit, he goes, if this is what you want to do, you're just gonna waste your time.
Interesting.
And so I took that advice, but it was actually hard to find a job. My dad told me, oh, as soon as you graduate from college, there's gonna be firms lining up left and right to hire you. And when I, you know, 07, 08, the economy went down and there's just
nobody was hiring.
No one was hiring. Yeah. So it was a struggle. So I took an internship.
That was a circumstance of timing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I took an internship with my business partner, who I'm partners with now. I actually started interning with him. And I remember it was $12.50 an hour, I think, $13 an hour.
Okay.
And my dad was like, you're not taking that job. You know, that's I'll pay you more than that. And I'm like, Dad, I don't want to work for you. Like,
right.
I'm just going to do it. He's like, all right, man, do it if you think it's what's best. Oh, my God, I'm so glad I did that. Because I jumped right into tax. Interning with Nathan, my business partner. And then I was actually working for them part-time, working for another CPA in the building, Jim Neri, this older guy. I learned a lot from him. He was older, had different ways of doing things, different clientele. So I learned a lot from him, learned a lot from Nate. And it was just an internship. There was no like, hey, you're going to have a job after this. It was just internship through tax season. And then my business...
The two CPAs were probably... Two very much different schools of...
Oh, yeah. Oh, you young and old.
Right.
You know, and you could totally tell the differences. And then, like, he learned stuff from us, and we learned stuff from him. We actually collaborated with him a lot. We'd actually go over to their office, have lunch, but yeah, we'll get into that. I'll jump back. But so I didn't have a job. I was just there and just collecting my learning. Mm-hmm. And my business partner, Nathan... he was a part-time contractor with Travis Matthew.
Right.
You're wearing the shirt.
Yep.
And he got offered a full-time job to be their CFO. And he was like, I want to be a CFO. And he took the job. So because he took the job, he was business partners with his wife at the time. And so I basically, they were like, hey, he's going to leave now. We would like to hire you. Would you like to work for us? I was like, yes.
You were thrust into this.
I was like, you luck. Thank you, Jesus, for getting
sometimes
me.
It's way better to be lucky than good.
Oh, yeah. Know? Oh, it was pure luck. I could have taken another probably internship somewhere else. It would have never amounted to anything. Like, it was luck. Just luck got handed to me. Mm-hmm. And it all just grew from there.
Yeah. Good never. For you. So what does the firm look like now? I mean, I know it's gone through some separation and all this, but what... Boroff Nyberg today.
Yes. So
as
of today, myself and my business partner, Nathan Boroff, we are 50-50 partners. We share everything. We're one and the same.
How many returns around?
So between the two of us, we have, I want to maybe say 300 businesses.
Okay.
And 800 individuals.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's our number. I'm like thinking in my head of our tax program because it's got numbers at the bottom of, in each module. This is how many clients you have in here. So
right. Okay.
I'm doing some rough numbers. Yeah, in my head.
We won't hold you accountable to the exact number.
Yeah.
But just getting gauge.
So we're definitely a small firm. We're not
boutique style firm. We're
boutique. Yeah, yeah. We focus on medium to small businesses.
Right.
That's great. Some of our medium sized businesses have turned into massive businesses that you know, moved on, you know, mainly because they got acquired by someone else but yeah, that's kind of like our makeup is medium to small businesses.
Yeah.
We do a lot of individuals, you know, because if a really good client, I'd love to only take businesses, but that would never work because when you have great clients who refer you their friend, you know, you got to take that client
right.
for them.
Yeah.
You know, because
Birds of a feather flock together. Yeah. You know, usually these are going to be of similar status and needs in terms of their tax planning and
exactly.
all that.
And you never know what that next client, who they're going to refer you to.
Right.
So, you know, I don't turn anyone away.
That's good. Great. Well, here we are in June.
Yeah.
In the midst of a new administration coming out of a pandemic. There's so much happening right now. It's hard to get our fingers wrapped around what the potential tax legislation is going to look like and all that. And so we touched a little bit on the fact that we were talking before, this Biden's, you know, the current administration's potential tax increases and what the landscape would potentially look like from a legislation standpoint. Maybe we can touch on just a few of the specifics that what I would say is your clients are coming to you, your business owners saying, man, I'm hearing this and this is what seems to be very real versus maybe way off in the distant or less likely to happen if I was a gambling person or gambling man.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe we could just touch on that a little bit and unpack a few of those specifically.
So it kind of comes from two aspects when clients call me. The first aspect would be clients who are, am I going to owe more? You know, can you explain to me like how this is going to affect me? And then there's the clients who are calling who are like, hey, I saw on TV that there's going to be a larger child tax credit and they're going to like give it to people early. Do I qualify for that? You know?
God, it's amazing how people are just so, it's innate in us. But it's like just responding, reactive to our pocketbook.
Yeah.
Purely.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. It's the pocketbook. That's a great way to put it.
It drives our behaviors so dramatically.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. And it's hard to explain to a client with like real numbers, like how it's really going to affect them because we don't know, right? Like we hope that when Biden puts together all these tax increase plans that they kind of balance it out a little bit. We saw that with Trump's plan, right? He took some here, but he gave some here. You know, for a good example would be they lowered overall taxes, increased the standard deduction, which benefited a lot of people, but they also capped state taxes. Right, $10,000. That hurt a lot of people, especially California residents. Mm-hmm. You know, your property taxes in California, the on the low end now are like $10,000
right.
for our average client. Yeah, on the high end, $30,000. So you take away that deduction, it's huge. You know, it makes a big deal, especially when you don't qualify for the child tax credit that they increase. So we saw, there was a balancing act. Another big one that they got rid of was for W-2 employees. You know, if you've heard of this, they got rid of unreimbursed business, employee business expenses. So if your employer doesn't provide you with a cell phone, but you use it for work, well, you can't write that off for federal tax purposes anymore. So curious to see how the Bidens balance everything out. I've heard, you know, we could go through some of these, you know.
Yeah, they're a few.
So, for example, everyone knows 39.6% tax bracket on the high end, that's coming back. Like, we've had it forever. I could understand that one. That's not a big one. I guarantee you that's going to come back.
And it's not a dramatic increase going from current 37 to 39.
Yeah.
For the highest income earners.
Exactly. So this is...
Tick the box, move on, right?
Exactly. I think the
big... The corporate one's a big one, right?
Yeah. So I don't deal with a lot of C corporations. So I know they're talking about like C corp rates going from like 21 back to 28. I don't deal with a lot of C corps, minor LLCs, partnerships, S corporations. They're all pass-through entities where everyone's paying taxes at the individual level. And so I don't have any issues with that. It's only 7% they're talking about. I think the big one that's going to apply to a lot of people, especially a lot of my clients, is if you make over $1 million, long-term capital gains rates are going to go up to 43.4%. That's what they're talking about.
All right. So let's define the world that would encompass long-term capital gains rates for you know.
The biggest one, well, obviously, like, everyone's getting rich in the stock market right now, right?
Yep, socks.
Everyone's holding on. Everyone's got big gains. So
real estate.
Real estate, that's a huge one.
Right.
Selling your business.
Okay, business. I've been in business 20 years. I'm getting ready to retire.
Yeah.
Today, when I retire, what kind of a tax liability am I looking
exactly.
at?
Exactly. And you could be looking at somebody where, like, you might think, like, oh, you make over $1 million, not a big deal. Well, look at somebody who's held some real estate forever. They don't make a lot of money. They just... built their wealth on real estate and they want to go sell this property. Okay, your gain's going to kick you up and you're going to make over $1 million now on the sale of this property. And now you're going to pay 43.4% instead of 23.8, I believe would be the max rate for federal.
Because we're in California, you got California.
Yeah, California 13.3 is the highest rate in California. You pay ordinary rates California always.
Right.
California is talking about raising their rates to 16.4%, I think now. 16.8
plus the 43.8 potentially. Yeah,
that'd be 59%, 60%.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Especially if, like, you have a big gain. Let's just say your gain's $2 million and you're thinking, okay, yeah, that's, what's my taxes? Well, the tax on that next million, $600,000.
So this is where things like 1031, in the case of a real estate holding, 1031 exchange becomes critically important to make sure you're utilizing and taking full advantage of that. But there's also talk, correct me if I'm wrong, that they might massage that and putting that mildly in some way.
They're talking about that. I'm actually doing a lot of 1031 exchanges right now. I've done the most 1031 exchanges this year and for next year that I'm doing ever.
Wow.
A lot of people, too, getting out of California. I have a client, 1031 exchanging land, real estate in California, moving it over to Hawaii.
So real quick, just give me, not to get particulars with this, but what are the kind of guidelines of a 1031 exchange? How does it have to work for the people listening?
There's a book that's like 2 inches thick.
Right. It's a Bible.
Yeah, it's a Bible. So there's tons of stuff.
But like for a layman person, I'm coming to you and I'm like, hey.
You can't put money in your pocket in the deal.
Got it. So it has to be a physical transfer of a real estate holding.
Yes.
To
real estate for real estate, like kind.
Like kind, lesser, more.
It's got to be, so you can, it doesn't matter how many properties you go from. You can go from 1 to 2, 2 to 1. It's just whatever you sell for, you have to buy equal to or greater value.
Got it. Okay.
If you don't, they get the term boot. Boot triggers taxable income.
Right. Okay. So I can go to, a real estate partnership. I could go to a REIT. I could go to, a portfolio of investments. I could go to an individual property. That one property can buy two properties. It just all has to be pooled in the same transaction. It cannot be, it has to be equal or greater in value. That's the general guideline. Mm-hmm. And I gain the benefit of kicking the can down the road.
Yes.
From a tax standpoint, becomes critically important if I'm going to pay 60%.
Yeah. Man. And the one thing you got to remember
is. And a million is not a lot.
It's not. No.
Not in California or, on both coasts.
No.
That's, what's the average home median in Orange County now? 750 grand or something like that?
Probably got to be more than that now. I think like. 750.
Maybe Danielle can look that up.
I feel like 750.
Median.
I've got a lot of friends that are trying to buy houses, and they're like, "Oh, I can't sniff anything for 750."
Gosh.
So that's got to, that, to me, that's the bottom end. But I guess you don't look at the outer reaches of certain cities. You know, I'm sure in Long Beach, there's probably property for still $300,000-$400,000 you could probably get. It's just not in the
Norco. Yeah. You know. Riverside area, things like that. Maybe, I don't know.
Look at Costa Mesa. That's what I want to, Costa Mesa. And that's the median price in Costa Mesa has got to be
expensive.
$1.5 million
Yeah. Which is insane to me. Where we grew up. This is where we grew up. It's crazy values. All right. What other kind of potential tax?
So yeah, that was a big one. The $1 million long-term capital gain. Corporate rates. Yeah, this is all the same.
You know, it's an interesting thing because there's so many different items that are being discussed. And so you kind of say, okay, well, as you look at each line item, you try and say, okay, what's the probability that this actually occurs? And when does it occur? And is it, are some of these going to be retroactive?
That's my biggest question, right? When did they put it in place? When's it going to be effective? What are they like? They're talking about proposed, like adding a lot of things. I'm more curious what they're going to take away. You know, are they going to take away that 20% QBI deduction? That's a big one, right? You know, they're talking about increasing the corporate tax rate, but are they going to get rid of the QBI deduction for LLCs, small business, you know, partnerships, S corps, you know,
and QBI,
qualified business income deduction.
Yeah.
So 20% of your qualified business income, you get a deduction on. We won't get into all the limitations, but that's a big one. If you have a small business owner that makes $100,000 for the year, that's a $20,000 deduction.
Yeah, that's
it. Huge.
20%.
You just went from paying tax on 100 to 80.
That's significant.
Exactly. So that's going to be a big hit for a lot of people. People are used to paying a certain amount of money every year for taxes. So that goes back to when I was telling most clients are calling me saying, what's going to change for me? Am I going to owe more? Because they want to know.
Right.
You know, that could be $3,000, $4,000 in taxes to them.
Yeah.
And it multiplies as you get businesses get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, that's significant. So what other questions are your clients coming to you with right now that are very timely? And then with that, the responses of strategies of saying, this is what I can advise you to do now. This is what you should consider.
So I get a lot. I've been doing a lot of estate tax planning.
Okay.
It's
great topic.
Yeah. So
let's get into that.
It's interesting. It's a lot of it's building from me. I'm trying to do a really good job of making sure all my clients have a trust, because I've done so many. I've had so many clients who've had someone pass away and they get stuck dealing with probate. So to anyone listening, get a trust if you don't have one.
Absolutely.
Put all your assets in, because you've no idea what's going to happen.
So we just finished, literally before you came in this door, we did a presentation with one of our broker-dealer firms, and the topic was, and we can make this available to anybody who's interested, financial planning begins with an estate plan. And one of the very first part of the presentation was talking about the difference between a will and a trust.
Yeah.
And one of the main takeaways at its basic level, not getting into the nuances of a will, was that a will is designed to be a document read to the probate court.
Yes.
So by nature, by definition, it's a document that's meant to be utilized as a tool in probate, not to bypass probate.
Yeah.
Huge understanding of what that is. Therein lies having a revocable family trust and the importance of that document and making sure that document is up to date.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing we see a lot of times. People will go, they'll pay somebody to do the revocable trust, but then they won't title the assets in the trust.
Yeah.
A house is the perfect example.
Bank accounts.
For most people, it's their single largest asset.
Yeah.
And they just leave it, whether that's individually owned or joint tenants in common or what have you, not in the name of the trust.
Yeah.
So good on you.
Yeah.
Step one.
So
have a trust.
Have a trust. So I'm trying to think of the best way to approach this in terms of, so with estate tax planning, the big hurdle is where is the estate tax exemption? What is it going to be, right? In 2003, the estate tax exemption was $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had an estate over $1 million and you passed away, you paid tax on anything above $1 million. Well, in today's age, in your SoCal, that's every client.
Right, every client.
That's every client. So, you know, since I think it was 2017 was when they increased it to 11 point, I think it's like 11.6 now. Yep. So really the way I approach is you kind of have to get an idea of what the client's like, hey, what are you worth?
Right.
You know, and then approach it from there. The average, my average client, they're not over that.
Right. Well, percentage wise, very, very few are.
Very few are.
Because that's 11.6 per
yes
person.
So, exactly. Yeah. So with that, it's really just making sure for the smaller client, make sure your trust is set up, make sure everything's in there,
yeah.
And just make sure you have all your assets in there. And if you've got real estate, the biggest one's just real estate. That's where most of my clients, it's like, hey, I've got this piece of property and I really want to sell it. And I'm like, well, I know you really want to sell it and you want the cash, but you're going to pay a lot of taxes on that.
Do you really want to pay all those taxes? Are you ready to do that?
Are you ready to pay that tax? Like, are you ready? Some clients I see, they're like, I don't want to deal with that. I actually had a client that sold a commercial building. He owned like 25% of it. He got like $4.5 million. He's 80. And I was like, don't sell it, man.
Step up in basis.
Get the stepped up basis when you yeah. pass away. Like, you know, you guys make a lot of money. We can transfer this into like a real estate investment trust, something that you don't have to manage, because he managed it. He goes, I don't want my kids to deal with it.
Right.
I don't want my kids to deal with it. So he sold it and paid all the taxes. I couldn't convince him.
Wow.
Couldn't convince him.
You know, hey, look, at the end of the day, you can lead somebody, you lead the horse to the trough, but you can't make him drink the water.
Exactly. But most of those conversations are around, hey, educating them on that property, what your basis is. If you want to sell it, this is what you're going to pay in taxes. If you don't sell it, you know, your kids are going to get a stepped up basis and not pay any taxes on it.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, that's another thing that's on the topic of them saying, we might massage, I keep saying the word massage, but make an adjustment to step up on basis. I mean, I find that highly unlikely that that would actually come to reality.
I think,
but it's on.
Yeah, I think he put in there.
It's written somewhere in these documents that they're trying to maybe potentially eliminate that.
Yeah,
I mean, from a real estate standpoint, that would be devastating.
Yeah, so it's the stepped up basis on death, and they're going to get rid of. They're talking about getting rid of that. I think they put a cap. They're talking about a cap though, of $1 million. So the first $1 million of real estate, you can get a stepped up basis. Anything over $1 million,
you'd start to apply.
You'd start to pay taxes.
Yeah.
At you know your date of death.
It's all very interesting. You know, it also with just your experience in that 80-year-old, it's a very interesting experiment to see how your role, right, is to inform them, educate them. And it's evident that sometimes people are just making a purely emotional decision and the emotion outweighs the financial benefit or loss. You know, they make, it just goes to show like from a human behavior and, you know, human psychology standpoint of how important sometimes emotional toll is a driver of decisions.
He even liquidated all of his IRAs. He didn't want to deal. I was like, you just put it in your kid's name.
Wow.
He goes, no, I just want to, I want to cash it out.
All the IRAs? I mean, you'd better off recharacterizing them to a Roth. I mean, pay all the taxes, put it in a Roth, then it's fully tax-free.
He just wanted cash in one bank account.
Who knows? There's definitely more.
He had a life insurance policy that
he
cashed in.
Oh, he has other thoughts of Armageddon and things like that.
He just wanted cash in the bank.
Yeah, wow.
One account.
Wow. So what are the basic guidelines? What are you seeing in terms of Roth conversions today? I'm curious. People recharacterizing qualified money to Roths. I mean, do you see that predominantly? Because I would say there's a lot of interest in it. However, what is really the percentage of people that actually deploy?
It's the same clients that have been doing it forever.
Okay.
With me so far. Everyone's contributing to Roths right now.
So in a real world, what does that kind of look like? The ones who recharacterize, not contributing, because the high income earners were phased out, you know, they can't contribute to Roth. But
yeah.
Ones who are, let's say, they're taking, they're they are adopting the process of recharacterizing. Do you get really involved in that, or are they kind of doing that more or less on their own? Or?
I try to get really involved because I cannot tell you how often they do it wrong. They do something like, so you get backdoor Roth IRA, for example.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Or just contributing to an IRA and a Roth IRA in general. I can't tell you how often someone contributes and they weren't allowed to. I actually just...
To a Roth.
To a Roth or a traditional IRA.
Right.
I had one client that this last year, I didn't even know. She didn't even tell me. She had been contributing to her Roth IRA, and she has a financial advisor too.
Right.
So I won't get into that because I feel like they should be asking the right questions too.
Absolutely. More so than you.
Yeah.
And over as the CPA.
Yeah. Over the last 4 years, she put 20 grand into it. It's obviously grown. And I have finally asked her the right question, and all of a sudden she was like, oh yeah, she gave me like a spreadsheet. That's what it was. And she had in there a Roth IRA. And I was like, hey, are you going to contribute to a Roth? She like, I already did. I'm like, oh, you got to pull it out. I was like, you guys make too much money. You're over the income limit. I was like, you can do a backdoor Roth IRA if you want. I can explain that to you. You can contribute non-deductible to your IRA, and then we'll convert it into the Roth. But as they have a pro rata rule, and you know, I don't want you to get caught up in that because I think you have an IRA. And she's like, whoa, I need to talk to my financial advisor because I've been doing this for like the last 4 years. And I went, oh God. I was like, you need to call your financial advisor and talk to them. You got to pull all the money out. So luckily, but like this is happening all the time, every year. So I try to tell clients, I'm like, hey, anything can happen that would potentially disqualify you from contributing to these. There's a reason why they give you from January 1st of the following year to April 15th to contribute.
Right.
So that you can consult with your tax advisor of whether or not you can actually make the contribution or not.
Right.
So my clients that are doing, I just try to tell them, hey, I know people like to put it in a little bit every month, but things happen. Just try to do it, you know, between April 1st and January 1st and April 15th and confirm with me that you still qualify.
Right.
You know.
Can I make the contribution?
Yes. Because people are switching jobs all the time. Like, hey, yeah, you were there. They didn't have a 401k, but then you switch jobs and now you're with a new employer and they have a 401k.
Yeah.
Immediately you're disqualified from your IRA now.
So explain this backdoor IRA process.
So
just simply high level.
Simplest way is there's nothing in the IRS code that says you cannot contribute to your traditional IRA. The only thing it talks about is whether or not you get a tax deduction for it. So the simplified overview of a backdoor Roth IRA is you contribute money to your traditional IRA up to, you know, 6,000 now. You don't get a tax deduction for it. And then once you make the contribution, you do a Roth conversion. When you do a Roth conversion, it triggers, you're supposed to pay tax on the Roth conversion, but since you never got a deduction on the initial contribution into your IRA, it's a tax-free loophole of getting money into your Roth.
Into the Roth.
But it gets tricky because they have this thing called a pro rata rule. Easiest way I can explain it is just say you had $95,000 in a traditional IRA and you put $5,000 of non-deductible Roth contributions or non-deductible IRA contributions into that traditional IRA, you have $100,000. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to convert that $5,000 into a Roth, you have to do it pro rata based on the taxable portion of your IRA and the non-taxable. So 5,000 of 100,000, 5%. So you would trigger a taxable event there. So in that sense, it doesn't make sense to do the Roth conversion.
Mm.
But there are ways around that.
Right.
For example, if you have an employer with a 401k plan, a lot of times they'll allow you to roll over your funds into their plan. So then you get your money out of your IRA, and now you no longer have an IRA. So you can do the Roth conversion.
Right. Interesting.
There's little tricky.
Yeah, you've got to look under the hood, get involved, ask your CPA.
Yeah.
Ask an informed financial advisor, right?
Yeah.
Or always consult with a tax professional.
So that client, this is the first time I've ever had a client who had been doing it for years. But now I have to deal with, so there's a 6%. I can't remember what they call the tax, but it's a 6% fee every year you put money into an IRA or a Roth IRA or into a Roth IRA and it didn't qualify and you didn't take it out. So
over that 4-year period.
And it's 6%.
The first deposit was 6% per year for 4 years.
Yes.
The second deposit was 6% for the 3 years, so on and so forth.
Correct.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So luckily we caught it. So her 2020 contributions, as long as you rectify it before the due date of the return, which would be October 15th, not subject to the 6%. But on all the old stuff, they are subject to it.
Yeah. Interesting.
So got to figure that one out for them, because there is a form. I either have to amend their return to charge the tax on them, or I'm trying to find out if you can just pay all the tax on your 2021 return when you do the conversion.
So let me ask these other questions. Let's do employees and business owners.
Okay.
You're seeing so much migration around the country, mm-hmm. one state to the other, wherever it is. I saw a number, it'll come to me, the amount of people that have migrated since the pandemic.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the advantages of me moving from, you know, a state income tax state to a non-state income tax state. It's very simple as an employee, but let's explain that. But and then it's definitely more particular for a business owner.
Yeah.
So we could just kind of high level explain how that all works. Employees, easy. So, I move from a state tax state to a no tax state.
Yeah, no more state taxes. They just,
I gain the benefit.
You gain the benefit. Whatever you're paying into your, they take out of your W-2, they don't take it out anymore.
Done. Now, business owners, that becomes a little bit more sticky because of where I'm domiciled, where I do business, how I do business, how many employees I have.
Correct. So the issue you kind of run into there is where exactly is your business and where are your employees? So a lot of people think, it's funny. I get this all the time. Clients think that they can incorporate their business in another state and not pay taxes, even though they're California residents.
I just become a Nevada Corp.
Yeah.
I'm just a light or Wyoming or wherever it is.
I've heard it 30, 40 times.
Wow.
Yeah, I just have to incorporate in Nevada and I don't pay any taxes. I'm like, yep, but you live in California. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with where the LLC or the corporation is domiciled.
Yeah.
You know, the filing.
Exactly. Yes. A lot of people incorporate their entities in Delaware, right? Just because of all the, you know, benefits there. But if you're in California, you still got to pay California taxes. So you kind of have to... It's really easy when you can just uproot your entire business and move it to that state. I had a client who actually paid all of his employees were all willing to move to Texas.
Okay.
Okay. You know, I'm my only client that's moved to Texas. And he paid all of his employees lease break fees to get them to move.
Wow.
Because he wants to get everyone to Texas. Because if he keeps an office here, keeps employees.
He's having to file a California return.
He's having to file a California return. And then you have to look into, okay, well, how do we determine sourcing of income? You know, do we do it based on wages? You know, hey, half your wages are in California, half your wages are in Texas, 50-50.
Two returns.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Two state returns.
Yeah. You're still stuck paying some California taxes.
Right.
So he uprooted, everyone's gone.
So the basic general rule for a company is what? To filing returns, very simply. So I'm the owner, my business, let's use an example. I'm the owner, my business stays physically located in California. Mm-hmm. I move to, let's use Texas as an example, Florida, no state income tax state. I'm an employee of my company, also the business owner. I gain advantage as the employee.
Yes.
For my employment wages.
Correct.
Of the no state income tax state.
Yep.
However, the business is still filing a California return in this example.
Yes.
For what? All the...
So you have to look at there's the way you would source it would be based off of the simplest ways, wages, right? So if you have $1 million of wages and you've got, I'm just making up random numbers here, but let's just say you have $800,000 of wages in California and you have $200,000 of wages in Texas, well, you have a 80-20 split.
Yep.
So you source 80% of your income to California, 20% goes to Texas. So when you go to prepare your return, you're just filing your K-1 gets split up, right? If your profit was $1 million, you're going to have $800,000 of sourced income to California. That's what you're going to pay tax on, just that $800.
So what about this? Let's say I have a company and I have 20 employees. I like creating all these scenarios. So in the example, 20 employees, we physically uproot all 20 employees.
Yep.
And we move to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now, everybody physically is domiciled in Florida, no yep. state income tax.
Yep.
But yet 95% of our sales are generated from customers in California.
So that's a great question. So I don't know the exact answer to this yet because...
Well, what is California's answer? Let's ask that. Let's look at it from their perspective first, and then let's look at it from the gray area of strategy.
Well, California is trying to say if all your customers are in California, you got to pay taxes to California.
Regardless of whether your yeah. employment, you're physically...
The perfect example is like my industry, right? Like I do tax returns. They're trying to say if I wanted to move my practice out of California to Texas or Florida or Washington and all my clients were in California, they want to tax me on all my earnings from California.
Regardless of where you're physically living, yeah. residing.
That's what they're saying.
Wow.
And I don't know
that's aggressive.
If they're really going to go pursue after that. This. The thing about California is California's got money. They go after stuff. California is very aggressive. They do their research.
Right.
Like I've had.
And they find.
Oh, yeah.
They find you.
Yeah. I've had California ask for everything they could possibly get in an audit. Federal, they just fill out spreadsheets, man. California, though, oh, man, they dive into things. I've had them ask for your divorce decree. I've asked them, they've asked for crazy stuff.
Wow.
That's to dig, scary. To like to
find whatever they can.
Yeah,
amazing.
So,
all right. Well, here we are in June, yep. right? It's mid-year. What should individuals and/or business owners be doing, or could they be doing now, to prepare them so that come Thanksgiving they're not calling you with this, you know, panic mode or December 15th, right? of like, hey. What can I do? I've got to figure this out, and which I'm sure happens.
Yeah, that's always going to happen.
Or December 30th, they yeah. call you.
Because the hard part, generally, it's getting your records together.
Yeah. Right?
I always tell clients, like, keep track of your stuff.
Right.
You know, do bookkeeping.
See, Danielle, we keep receipts.
Yeah.
It's important to keep the receipts.
Because the only way you can do good tax planning is if you know what you've done so far year to date. You know, then you project forward from there.
You know, I don't want to make this too generic, but yeah. but it's important for people. So simple thing, you have an expense. You're wondering if this is advantageous from a tax planning standpoint. What do they do?
So
file it, just throw it in a file.
No. So I guess the best way for maybe me to explain this is because most clients, you've got new businesses and existing businesses, right? The existing businesses that have already been established, they're just looking for ways to write off more stuff, right? And then their questions are like, hey, can I write this off? Can I write that off? You know, the big one, vehicles over 6,000 pounds, right? Fully depreciable for federal tax purposes. So there's a lot of like planning in terms of like your expenses and what can we do to maximize our deductions. How much pay, like S corp owners, how much payroll do I need to pay myself? You know, so that I can do my 401k and max my profit sharing, right? There's a lot, I do a lot of that. But there's been this wrench that got put into that, you know, concept with the QBI deduction, that we talked about, that 20% QBI deduction. So mm-hmm. a lot of our planning that we're doing, you know, mid year is making sure we run the right amount of payroll so that you can put in as much as you want into your retirement account, but also not run too much payroll. Because if you run, the more payroll you run to yourself, the lower your business profit goes, which means you miss out on that 20% QBI deduction.
Oh, right.
So we play this balancing act of like, what, how does this, you know, pertain to you, and how does it fit you the best? That's a big thing we're doing.
And that varies from business to business based on revenue, or is there pretty much this kind of sweet spot or a range?
There is a sweet spot.
Okay.
The reason there is a sweet spot is because once, if you're a personal service business, and married, filing a joint versus single, once you make over 200,000, there's extra steps that you have to meet in order to get the QBI deduction. One of them is the QBI deduction is limited to 50% of your wages. So in some circumstances, we have to run more payroll in order to get the max QBI deduction. So but that also has its side effects. The more payroll you run, the more Social Security, Medicare taxes you pay. So there's a balancing act. There's no perfect formula to it. There is a perfect formula for determining how much payroll you need to pay yourself in order to get the max, you know, QBI deduction, but that also has other effects.
Right.
Because of, you know, Social Security, Medicare taxes, you know.
So many of our listeners are going to be, they're going to be in service professionals,
yeah,
which would be a financial advisor or wealth manager or insurance agent, right? And what's the major differences? What would be some of the differences between me doing a sole proprietorship, just receiving all my 1099s, because we're predominantly 1099 income, as to me, Mr. Agent, versus establishing an actual LLC or a business, and the differences of that? Or if I'm a one person shop, there isn't.
Yeah.
What is it?
So if you're looking at terms of like, are you looking at terms of sole proprietorship, like not incorporated business versus an incorporated?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So in terms for those people, some people are like, you can't incorporate, right? So a lot of our tax planning revolves around, you, for example, meet a new client, they own a business, they're sole proprietorship, they're not incorporated. Usually our first, you know, track to go down for planning is, hey, do you think you should incorporate? Some people can incorporate, so they're kind of strong-armed into, they just can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's usually the first step I go down is, hey, should you incorporate or not?
Right.
Because there's benefits to it and all. I won't get into all the details, but there are benefits to it.
Yeah.
Secondly, for sole proprietorships, the hard part is, so I actually, this happened to, for example, a client of mine. She didn't incorporate. We've been talking about incorporating for years, but she hasn't yet. And the reason she hasn't incorporated yet is because she has a side job where she already has W-2 earnings.
Right, she's wages.
So she's already got wages. She's already paying Social Security, Medicare taxes. And so we haven't incorporated her business yet because she hasn't wanted to go through all the she just doesn't want to go through all bank accounts, updating all of her licenses and all this stuff. Because if we converted her to an S-Corp, well, she's not going to save that much money in taxes, right? That's usually the benefit of setting
the driver, pocketbook.
Yeah. Pocketbook.
It's
going to save some Social Security, Medicare taxes. In her instance, it's not. So I've always talked to her about, hey, you might want to incorporate. And the reason why is as she makes more money, eventually she's going to get over that income limit of 200,000. She doesn't make that, and it wasn't making a crazy amount of money. But once she gets over that limit, she doesn't get the QBI deduction anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this last year, she killed it because of COVID, went way over, ended up making like $500,000 that year. And her earnings from her self-employed business were like $300,000. But she didn't qualify for the QBI deduction. Mm. So you're talking about a $60,000 deduction that we missed out on.
Wow.
We could have.
Because she didn't plan.
She didn't plan.
Pre-plan.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the things would be, look, if you're going to have a dramatic adjustment in income in any capacity.
Got to talk to me.
Got to talk to the CPA. Yeah. A tax professional. What do I do?
Yeah.
Two, any large purchases.
Yes.
Any large a vehicle.
Yep.
A real estate holding. Starting a business.
Starting a business, hands down.
Relocating a business.
Yeah. So a good aspect to go over about starting a new business is usually when you start, like, you know, most people that are starting a business, they got a W-2 job. They've got earnings. And so you go in to start this business, you got a lot of startup costs. And so normally you would think, oh, write off as much as we can, right? Our goal is to get as much deductions as we possibly can. But there are circumstances, though, where that isn't the best strategy. Mm. So I ran into this.
Why?
So a good example. So I have husband and wife. Between the two of them, they've got W-2 jobs to make like $200,000 a year. Their family is big in farming. They wanted to set up an orchard. It's a orange, or I think it's oranges. So they bought a farm, and they've segregated out the land into like lots. And they're like, okay, we're going to plant this lot. It's going to cost us, you know, $95,000 to replant, irrigation, everything. The next phase two, which is the next spot over, is going to be like another, you know, $95,000. So I broke it all down for them because they were like, hey, we want to go exempt on our W-2s so we don't pay all the taxes. We know we got all these write-offs mm-hmm. for federal tax purposes. We're going to accelerate the, you know, all the irrigation. We're going to accelerate the trees because it's all fully depreciable.
Right.
And so they're like, you know, what am I going to owe in taxes? So I go through the numbers. I'm like, okay, well, you guys got itemized deductions. You're going to spend about $95,000 this year. After all these write-offs, you guys aren't going to pretty much owe any federal taxes. And so on the $95,000, if I threw in the $85,000, all I did was kept reducing their wages, but they've got mortgage interest, property tax. They have the itemized deductions that they have.
Right.
Child
tax. That they weren't accounting for.
Exactly. So I had to explain to them. I said, look, if you go for that next lot of land, dollar for dollar, it's not going to save you a whole lot of taxes.
Wait till next year.
Because next year you guys can go exempt again for federal tax purposes. And then you're going to save at the 24% bracket instead of 10.
That's real money.
That's a lot. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh my God, we're so glad you brought that up because like that is easing us because we were just like, oh, should we go and get the second lot going? And you just made it easier for us to make that decision. But if you would have never, you know, we would have never thought. Most people would think like, okay.
Just more deductions.
I make $200,000. I'm paying, you know, $200,000 for this farm. I should write it all off so I don't pay any taxes.
Right.
No, you're losing out on deductions now.
Yeah, yeah. The other one too, just kind of going back to the backdoor Roth, you know, IRA Roth strategy is thinking about harvesting specific tax brackets.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't really even know what their AGI is and what the room is to say, okay, because what happens in many cases, well, advisor says or XYZ, or maybe just people independently make the decision, we're going to convert all of this because of whatever we think the future is going to hold. We're going to convert this all to tax-free. And next thing you know, they go from, you know, let's say a modest, middle of the road federal tax bracket to through the roof.
37. Boom.
And they didn't do the proper, well, to me, that's kind of, they need someone like you to do, for lack of a better explanation, a pro forma.
Yes.
Of saying, before we do this, let's look at what the impact will actually be on your return.
Yes.
And right now, the current tax brackets are set to sunset 2022, right? Unless there's a Biden.
Yeah.
Unless something changes.
Yeah.
So, and they're pretty modest, right? I mean, meaning the ranges are very generous.
Yeah. So there's one big jump in the brackets. I believe it goes from 15 to 22, there's a big jump.
We can pull it up.
Yeah.
She can pull up the...
I can't remember which one it is.
Our tax bracket. You could probably throw it on the screen.
I should know it, right? It should be ingrained in my mind.
There's a lot of numbers, but that is your job. Absolutely, right?
But yeah, we could jump back to that. But yeah, there are a lot of jumps that you can, you know, or... Good example is people don't realize that you have a lot. I've retired clients that a lot of their income is capital gain income. Well, if you're in the lowest tax bracket for federal tax purposes, you don't pay any taxes on your capital gains. And so I'll have clients that will, you know, if they do a Roth conversion or take a big lump sum from their IRA, the most common is the lump sum IRA withdrawal. So these are retired people, capital gain income, Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
They go take $100,000 out of their IRA.
To do whatever.
And I'm like, could you have just spread that out over a couple years? They're like, well, no. Like, well, yeah, I probably could have. I'm like, well, you should have, and here's why. Now your Social Security is taxable.
85.
Now you're paying capital gain taxes.
Yep.
So I'm like, you took out 100, and now you owe 50.
You just popped the balloon.
Yes.
In a big way.
So,
yeah, so here we go. File it, married,
there you go.
Jointly.
12 to 22. It goes up 10%.
Most people are going to be here, though, right? Married, filing jointly.
Yeah, 24, but like, you got to look at.
I mean, this is huge.
Retired.
172 to 329 at 24, 81 to 172, 21 or 22, I mean.
So, yeah, I think you got to look at the 20 to 80 for retired people, right? So that's a big one. People that are retired, they've got $3 million in their investment account, IRAs. They're not paying a lot of taxes because they don't.
Right.
So that's the ones where I see, hey, you just went from 12 to 22 now, capital.
That's a huge bump.
It's a huge bump. They don't realize.
I mean, what's the difference between 22 and 24? It's so modest.
Yeah.
But going from 12 to 22 is huge.
Especially when you didn't pay tax on your Social Security before. You also didn't pay tax on your capital gains.
And now you're paying taxes on it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important things to look at.
It's
you got to be careful about
that. It adds up. So that's one thing is like people that are making those decisions, like you reach out, you know, double check with me. Hey, what is this going to happen if I do this? Because money's money, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's, like you said at the beginning, everyone's looking at their pocketbook. All decisions are based off their pocketbook. But in that one, they're so driven by that money. Let me get it now.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. All right. Any other, you know, advice that you could give some of these listeners or financial advisors of thinking what they could do or their clients before year end?
Before year end?
Like now, what should they start thinking about now that we know, not what could be coming down the pike? Because let's think in concrete terms here.
Like if assuming nothing changes for business owners.
What are the standard things? Like if you're an employee, obviously you should be maxing out your qualified plans, HSA plans.
Look at your HSAs. Another big one, people that are W-2 employees should be reaching out, who have children that do childcare. They should be reaching out to HR because they just increased the child independent care FSA, the flexible spending accounts that you can get. It used to be $5,000 per family. They just bumped it up to, I believe, $10,500.
Oh, that's a lot.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in the, you know, 32% bracket on another $5,000, that's, you know, $1,500 in tax savings.
Yeah, that's a lot.
For money that you're already spending.
Right. The other one I heard is there's going to be 36 million people that get this child tax credit from the IRS. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of
people. How do I know if I'm going to get that or not? Do we know?
I believe,
I just heard that headline.
I believe it's going to be based off of your previously filed returns.
Okay.
So they're going to look at 2020. If you qualified on 2020, they're going to front you the money. Hmm. It's not free. So if you don't qualify for the child tax credit the next year, you got to give it back, understanding.
Okay.
All they're doing is paying it forward. Hey, we're going to give it to you early.
Now, because you need it.
Which is, a lot of people, be prepared, because if you get it early and you're used to getting a $5,000-$6,000 refund, now you're not. You're not going to get a refund at the end of the year because you already got your child tax credit.
Mm.
You know, think about a family.
All they're doing is paying it forward.
Yeah.
Okay, so be aware of that. Be careful.
Yeah, especially for people that set up their withholding for W-2s where they want to be right at break even. You know, hey, if you're going to get the prepaid child tax credit, you're not going to get it at the end of the year now, so you're probably going to owe. So that would be a good one to double check if you get it, if they do it and you get it and you get it early.
And as it stands now, everything's back to normal in terms of when I file my returns.
Yeah.
Now that 2020 is done.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So April 15th, back to the normal test, you know, or deadline date.
Yeah. For, in terms of my workload, I'm still crazy busy.
I'm sure.
This was the most exhausting tax season because we spent so much time on things unrelated to preparing people's tax returns. Like, we already can't get everyone's tax return done by April 15th. That's impossible. Not going to happen.
Right.
And so it's just been overwhelming.
Daunting.
Yeah. Help, because everyone's got questions with everything, right? Everyone got a PPP loan. Everyone wants help. You know, hey, Garrett, how do I get it, you know, forgiven? So not, you know, they're looking for me to help them with that because they don't want to mess it up.
Right.
Have you heard about the employee retention credits?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. These are huge. Everyone's like, I have tons of clients going after that now. But now it's so much work, right? If you're going, the problem with everything they do when they rush out these credits and all these changes is they don't issue guidance, right? So it's up to us to interpret it. And then from there, you know, we have to wait for the tax softwares to update or the form to come out to do it. And then what's been happening in over the last 6 months is they come out with new guidance. So for example, like why we're so busy, we're amending returns now because if you live in a community property state, they have the $10,200 tax-free unemployment. And so it's per person. So if you're married, it was $10,400. But before, it was $10,200 on just your Social Security. So if your wife didn't have, or on your unemployment. So if your wife didn't have unemployment, you only got $10,200. Well, they just issued new guidance and said, if you live in a community property state, you can do $20,400 if only one person got the unemployment.
Really?
So now we have to go back, figure out, okay, well, who
does this affect? Yeah.
How do we find that out really quickly? All right. You know,
you got to do the work.
Go through all the clients, figure out who got unemployment. There's ways to filter, but then you got to check. But this is all, then you have to then reach out to the client, explain to them, hey, we have to amend your return. I'm going to save you money. Don't worry. But do I charge for it?
Yeah, that becomes where it becomes a double-edged, a slippery slope.
That's
because
why
it's time.
Yeah, that's all 100% it's all time. And it's work. You have to explain it to all of them. That's what we've been dealing with.
Chasing people down.
Exactly. Because you don't want to be that preparer who they reach out to you, hey, Garrett, did I qualify for this? You know, I don't want to get that email.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, oh.
In retrospect.
Yeah, like 3 months from now.
Right.
You know, I'd rather them get an email from me saying, hey, you just guess what? You're going to get some more money back.
You're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not an easy task.
Yeah. So, and there's like, I feel bad because there's one where the husband, they owed that year and his unemployment was like 11,000, you know, and he's really hurt and, you know, has to do a payment plan for the, you know, his taxes because he got hurt so bad.
They become a priority. They should be anyways in a perfect world, right?
The hard part for him when I'm going through my thought process of, okay, how do I tackle this? I go to look at his return and I'm like, okay, I'm going to reduce your unemployment by $800.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, do I charge for it? Okay,
cool. That's where you decide if it's pro bono or not.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I reduced your unemployment by $800. You know, I saved you $2,500, $250. I can't charge him for that.
Right, right.
So I don't.
Yeah.
You know, that's pro bono. And
that's good.
So.
So if people are interested in getting a hold of you and you're available to take on new potential clients, business owners, how can they?
Just call the office. Martha will pick up.
Okay.
Schedule a call.
The number?
562-314-4141.
Boroff.
Boroff. Boroff and Niver.
That's right. Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah.
Till next time.
Glad to be here.
All right.